Right, recording.
Okay, well, my name's Brian Micklethwaite and we're in my front room. We, because also present is my good friend Patrick Crozier. Hello, Patrick. And the reason I'm introducing this is because...
We're going to give the date.
So
the 19th of February, 2018.
Yes.
That's the...
And the reason I'm, although being heckled, doing the introduction... is because it's Patrick's turn to make the running conversationally. The first one of these we did, Patrick being the expert he is on World War One, he presented the agenda. The second one about television turned out I had a lot more to say on that than Patrick did. He was sort of sitting there going, yes. And now it's my turn to go, yes, with a thesis about the whole vexed question of immigration. And my first question, very simple. What is your proposition that you want us to discuss?
Okay, well, the formula, this is not mine. It was originated by a chap called Vox Day, to the best of my knowledge. It goes like this. Diversity plus proximity equals war. When I first heard him say that, I was delighted because that's something I have observed many, many times over the years. I mean, the obvious example is Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, you have a large number of... Well, we normally talk about Catholics and Protestants. I'd rather not talk about Catholics and Protestants because it's nothing to do with religion. What you have is a large number of Ulster British, it doesn't matter whether Ulster or not, but a large number of British, a large number of Irish, and certainly when I was growing up, there was a war. It was a low-level war. There was no front line as such, but you know, every so often... Pretty much every week, someone would get killed, or there'd be there'd be bombings.
Yeah, I think you need a fairly relaxed definition of war to make this true.
But
it's certainly not
the best
sweetness and light.
The best definition I heard of war is trying to impose your will on someone by violent means.
Mm.
That is exactly what the IRA was trying to do, and indeed, you'd have to say the British state was trying to do the same in reverse. So I would say it was a war.
One of the things I've always been curious about Northern Ireland was it possible to tell by just looking at somebody which tribe they were in?
No.
Even costumes, dresses, what they wore.
People occasionally talk about this sort of pantomime that goes on while people try to work out which side this person is on.
And the fact that they do that. Means it's hard to tell.
No, I mean the accent is the same. They don't look different. They wear the same clothes. In fact, I was very surprised to hear that they even support the same football teams. You're more likely. This is the 90s. You were more on a Republican demonstration. You're more likely to see Man United shirts than Celtic shirts.
Mm.
So no, that sort of changed.
But.
And
the point being that the diversity can be quite hard to discern, but it's still definitely present.
They still go around killing one another.
Yeah.
How do they know? Because they know where people live.
Mm.
You can tell by surnames. Mm. Those would be the main ones. Obviously, if you're wearing a uniform of any description,
mm-hmm.
you can be identified. So, I mean, they know.
Are there any other... examples of this that you have personally witnessed?
Oddly enough, yes. I did go on holiday to Bosnia a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And obviously by that stage the war had ended. There was no shooting, killing. But it is clear that the tensions still exist.
Mm.
The resentments still exist. And by the way, they still exist in Northern Ireland.
Mm.
I think as we speak, I don't quite know what's going on at the moment, but the rather odd cobbled together power sharing executive has fallen apart and seems to be
They don't seem to be able to agree what they think of Brexit and how to handle it. And that I'm not sure which side, but one of them's calling for direct rule. Is that right?
I don't know, I haven't really been
following. I heard somebody on the TV doing that, and of course the question is, whose fault was that? Was it the intransigence of the Protestants or the intransigence of the
Yeah,
the nationalists.
Yeah,
the unionists, I should say, not Protestants, because there are a few Catholic unionists, aren't there?
Tiny numbers.
Yes,
but they do exist.
Yeah,
But that's the whole point, because it's an ethnic conflict rather than a religious conflict. So if you're British and Catholic...
I want to call it tribal rather than ethnic, because it's very hard to talk about the ethnicity of Northern Ireland people, isn't it?
I mean, you have to be able to visually be able to tell people apart. Is that what you...
Well, I don't know what the dictionary definition of ethnic is, and I don't really care, but what were we talking about? Ethnic.
Yeah, I mean, ethnic versus tribal.
Yeah. Ethnic implies to me some kind of visual distinction that you can make and turn into a big fight if you want to. That's...
The thing is, tribal to me implies primitiveness. When this sort of thing can happen with, Northern Ireland is a very rich place.
Yeah.
No,
tribal, I see what you mean, grass skirts and spears.
Yeah.
I don't think of the word tribal as being only that, but that's a definitional superficiality.
Well, let's use the word tribal, we know what we're talking about.
But exactly. Bosnia is another one.
Yeah, but there are others in this world.
Oh, yes.
I thought.
But if I'm allowed to start saying what I want to say, which is, seems to me there's a very big difference between not so much a diverse place as a distinct place, namely where there are two big tribes or ethnic groups or whatever they are, or religions, of approximately equal size and power and capacity to make grief for each other. And I believe there are some Pacific Islands where this happens. And
Fiji is an example.
Yes, that's right. And that seems to me a very different situation to what prevails in a lot of London, where you have only a minority of people who are British living in London, or born white British, whatever they are, the one tribe. If you're going to have a big set two, then that might be one of the dividing lines. But the point is that all the other tribes are tribes plural. There's little clutches of people from all sorts of places. And the result is, on the whole, harmony. There are parts of East London where there are quite large tribes locally, and that's where it gets a bit nasty and a bit fraught. But most of London is harmonious, I think it's fair to say. I don't think I'm sugaring the pill. And the reason it's harmonious is because every time a little tribe descends upon England or London, particularly London, there's only a small number of them compared to the vast metropolis that is London. And they've either got to learn London's ways of talking and operating, or they're going to suffer very badly. And there's no possibility of them conquering London. You know, the New Zealand tribe cannot expect to overwhelm even one of the London boroughs. They couldn't.
Small tribes.
Yes, lots of small tribes. In other words, what I'm saying is that a little bit of diversity in the form of two sort of potential armies is very bad news.
I was going to say, I'm not sure I'd count Kiwis as being that diverse, because they would...
Quite.
Second generation would become perfectly British.
That's my point, because that's another point, which is, how diverse do you mean? Yes. But I mean, we've recently had a lot of Eastern Europeans coming to London. And
yeah, they're also a rather funny bunch. Yes, you have their Polish shops and Hungarian shops and things like this. But they're all going to go. Most of them will go home, and if they stay, again, the second generation.
I think it's worth pointing out that what people say they're going to do and what they end up doing is often very different. I mean, first generation immigrants are often very adamant that they're going to go back home, and they don't. They just hang around. It never quite makes sense to go back, and then their children are at school.
With the East Europeans, they have the advantage is that it's very easy to get back, and so long as these countries remain free and democratic, there's no, they don't have to worry about being become political prisoners. Also, the property is very cheap, so. That was my understanding. I mean, I haven't seen any.
Well, a friend of mine who's Polish, speaks fluent English, is just now, as we speak, going back to Poland very soon. I think it's also worth pointing out, just by way of sort of setting the tone of this conversation, that we are both members of the London Libertarian tribe, or whatever you call it.
Yeah.
And that tribe is very ethnically diverse.
Yes.
And that's a very interesting fact about it, I think. to me, very enjoyable and informative. I learn a lot about the world. I mean, I have meetings in this very room, and the one after next is going to be about, assuming all goes well, about the Brazilian libertarian movement. A couple of people we both know who are going to talk about that. To me, that's definitely a feature. And it's worth bearing in mind that these are probably the people who are going to listen to this podcast in the early stages. We ought to
yes.
have that in our heads while we talk about this. However, we're not going to let it put us off. I think we were just discussing beforehand about how this is a very fraught subject, full of unexploded material, which if you put
we don't want to condemn people just simply because of the colour of their skin.
Absolutely not.
We can't do that. But
Or the nature of the culture they were raised in, either, for that matter. It condemned them for doing bad things. That's what I want to condemn them for.
Yes. I mean, I think, getting back to your point about London, the problem is we don't know. We are conducting an experiment here, and there are very few precedents for it. Mm.
What about New York?
I think they're going on about the same time frame as us.
But
Bosnia, of course, was not two-sided. That was three-sided.
Yes, yes.
And was
awful. My proposition is that the smaller the number of identifiable teams, the more trouble you're going to get. Two being the worst. One is all right, but two is desperately dangerous. Three is pretty bad. Seven or eight, and you can start to relax. That's my claim.
Well, I mean, normally it is only a two-sided conflict. Bosnia was three-sided was a lot worse than
what I mean
Ireland.
Is that conflicts, by their nature, tend to be two-sided.
Yes.
That's what they are. In a three-sided one, you might have a huge bust-up between two of them based on the fact that they're both trying to get the other one to join them, or they both think they can.
Well, you had this bizarre situation, I think I'm right saying, in Bosnia, where you had three fronts at the same time.
Yes.
Three-handed
chess.
Experts could tell us, but yeah, I mean, the one stage it was the Serbs against the Croats, and then a year later it was the Serbs against the Bosnians, and then a little later it was the Croats against the Bosnians. You do get that. I mean, I think one of the things, the key things to point out about these situations is that it is, first of all, Northern Ireland and Bosnia were preserved. They were preserved by external powers, in that it never got really nasty all out in Northern Ireland because you had the British state, which was able to hold the ring, so to speak. Mm. It could actually prevent an Irish army invasion, for instance. And while you had a communist state in Yugoslavia, that tended to suppress everything. Mm. But of course, as soon as that state collapsed, it all came up again.
Which, of course, is very relevant to libertarians because we don't favour a strong state. But if these are the sort of situations where men of goodwill are liable to do just that, aren't they?
Hmm.
Okay. What's your reaction to the basic proposition I'm offering, that you get these single slabs of identifiable allies confronting each other? That's the nightmare scenario. Whereas London, most of London, parts of East London, I'll grant you, is looking a bit scary. But most of London, for now, looks very ethnically diverse, much more diverse than this double trouble thing. And for that very reason, more harmonious.
By the way, harmonious is
defined fairly low level. I just mean the absence of serious fight, one death a week kind of thing. Do you concede the basic proposition?
Not yet, I don't.
Ah.
You're
saying London, and wait and see.
Most of my argument is based on historical information, and we just don't have enough.
Yeah.
But I would point out.
Well, what is
I
mean, what is
Be-
so
well, un- no, I just, I guess the only historical examples I can think of, and that one was Beirut, and that was multi-sided, if I remember correctly, because you had Christians and you had various Druze and you had various Islamic sects. And that again was another bloodbath. I don't know. It's I'm not sure that's true. I mean, yes, we're doing okay in London so far.
But the thrust of what you're saying is that what is preserving London as a benign diversity is the state. All right, in the background, but ready to bloody well assert itself.
It was certainly interesting.
Certainly if any of
we do have some historical information, because if you remember the 2011 riots.
Hmm. Yes.
The police more or less disappeared mm-hmm. for 3 or 4
Well,
days.
That's what they always do. They always give up on the night and then spend the next 2 years boringly catching people who thought they got clean away with it. But that's what they do.
What was interesting was in that gap, various communities started to organise themselves in order to defend themselves.
Mm.
I'm pretty sure there were some Hindus doing this, mm-hmm. and I'm mm-hmm. quite sure there were some Millwall supporters as well.
Mm.
The point is that those tribes, those little tribes you talk about, you know, became very insular very quickly. So that's a little worry that I would, if the British state ever collapsed.
Well, it all sounds like an extremely powerful argument against libertarian anarchism, doesn't it?
Yes, and this sort of annoys me, because I think a lot of libertarians equate libertarianism with free movement. And I think they're just plain wrong on this. I think on any definition of, well, most definitions of libertarianism, there is no... The state can't exist. I can't see how you can have that.
Well, you certainly have something like the state, if not the state itself. That's my
That's my feeling, is that the roads will be privately owned, and over those roads, the owners will be sovereign, and they can, admit people on any grounds they like.
But but in the broader sense, there will still always be politics. People looking for different interests and the better sort. Oh, is it working still?
Where were we?
Well, libertarianism does not equal free movement, is what
you were proposing.
Yeah. And yet, in another sense, almost by definition, it kind of does.
You think?
Well, it's certainly one of the ideals to which we aspire. I mean, let me put it like this. I can imagine a world not so very far in the future, a matter of a very small number of centuries, and perhaps even just a dozen decades, when the current improvement of the circumstances of people around the world, which Steven Pinker talks about and many others, and there's a group called progress.org or something like that, where they have a graph which crawls along the bottom until it hits about 1800 and then it disappears off the top of the top right-hand corner of the page.
The Industrial Revolution was a wonderful thing.
It was a wonderful thing. And it is now spreading all over the world. And at the moment, there's lots of turmoil. And in the short run, it probably causes kind of immigration angst, because it means you've got a whole lot more people who can afford to travel than used to be the case.
Yeah.
So in the short run, you probably have these enormous waves of immigrants pouring in and creating these sorts of tribal duets that we've discussed, or chamber music, should we call it, you know, 3 or 4 groups, big groups capable of really making a nuisance of themselves if they really want to. But in the longer run, one hopes a world in which people won't be moving in such vast numbers. I mean, everyone, whenever you're optimistic about anything, people think you're being unrealistic. But often the optimists are correct and the pessimists are wrong. And so it's reasonable to at least hope that that sort of world will come about. And if it does, then we'll get the rather nice London situation I described, that there will be little gangs of, I don't know, white South African people, or for that matter, black South African people, or Bangladeshi Christians, you know, little groups of people like that. Do you remember the Kenya Nations who arrived in the Uganda Nations, those people? There will be the occasional little minority that up sticks and moves to maybe London.
Well, they're expelled, weren't they? So.
But they won't. It won't. There won't be this vast sense of a tidal wave of humanity happening so much. At least it's imaginable. And in a not, what will happen is that if this good scenario comes about, then people will suddenly realise what happened to immigration is a big argument. Lots of people are moving around the world and nobody seems to mind.
I would like to think that were true.
Yeah.
I would like to think that were true.
And surely, as a libertarian, we would aspire to such a world, would we not?
I think so, yes.
Yes.
I think
so. Simply because everybody has more freedom about where to live. And the fact that they're able to move profoundly influences the quality of where they live, because where they live rises or falls depending on really quite small numbers of people either arriving or leaving. You see this in the States of America.
Well, it was certainly interesting that the Soviets were desperate to prevent people moving.
Mm.
Because they could just see all the intelligent people leaving very fast and leaving not much left. So, yes, that's certainly true.
I mean, a world where most of the walls are for keeping people out is kind of an improvement on a world where they're keeping you in. It's not very nice, but it's better.
I'm trying to think of examples where walls were built to keep people in. Apart from the Iron Curtain.
Mm. Yes.
I'm struggling on that one. Mm. Yeah, that's almost unique. Maybe someone can think about it.
Because communism is almost uniquely frightful.
I mean, if I can get back to the Industrial Revolution for one moment, I do have something to say about that, and that is that the Industrial Revolution started for a reason. Because as best I can work out, in Britain, when it happened, was about the freest any country has ever been in history.
Mm.
You know, if you want human progress, you need freedom.
Mm.
Yes, it's now. Of course, now we have to explain why is it after 100 years of you know, the state expanding, we are still making progress. I guess it's because there's still enough freedom to allow that to happen.
Well, I think the state has to expand very, very much before freedom gets severely diminished. And it does. I mean, communism is precisely that. But
we both remember Britain in the 70s.
The state taking 10% of people's wealth in 1800 was pretty... It sounds like not much, but it was enough to hurt. Now the state takes more like 50. But it hurts us less because we're just a lot richer.
Yes.
There's a lot more for them to steal, and they can steal proportionately much more, and we still have lots of manoeuvring space around it.
Yeah, that's true. But I think on a more general point is that if you lose your freedoms, then you're in big trouble. And I suppose what I'm trying to say is that if you have an ethnic conflict, that is unlikely to promote freedom. Although, because I mean, one of the sort of depressing things about Northern Ireland politics is that there is no normal politics allowed.
Mm.
You can't have a debate between socialists and libertarians because you have to vote your tribe.
Mm. Mm.
If I'm confronted with a libertarian Republican, should there be such a thing, and a communist unionist, I will have to vote for the unionist. Mm.
I remember the joke about are you a Protestant atheist or a Catholic atheist? Which is the question
to which
asked.
The answer is I'm a Protestant atheist.
Yes.
Because that's where my family was.
Mm.
But then again, of course, it's nothing to do with religion. It's to do with
well, that makes the point, doesn't it? The point. Yeah. What else have I got on my mind?
Well, can I say
yes,
this is a sort of side issue?
Yeah.
Is it does seem to me to be a numbers game, and then maybe this does come into what you're saying.
I do
about
agree.
London.
I do agree.
One of the things I found difficult to understand. I've lived in Britain all my life, but my mother comes from Ireland and she's a Protestant, and my grandmother lived in Monaghan. Monaghan is 5 miles south of the border. Why was it that there was this low-level war going on 5 miles north of us, but not anywhere where we were? Apart from, there was a bomb in 1975, but other than that, no evidence. And of course the reason is there are almost no Protestants / Brits in Southern Ireland. I mean, it was 10% on independence.
And you didn't feel threatened because you were no threat yourself.
I didn't. As I ought to have done.
Maybe ignorance on your part. Maybe you were resented. But there was no thought of warfare because we all know who'd win.
Yes. Exactly.
I grew up in an even more extreme situation, a little town, well, little village sort of mixture, a suburban place called Englefield Green. And there was one Asian family. And there was, if there was grief, I knew nothing about it. I mean, maybe there were a few people grumbling, but there was no conceivable sense in which that could threaten the, you know, the suburban peace of Englefield Green, because they were completely outnumbered.
Yeah, this is one family.
And that was that.
But what if it had been 100 families or 1,000 families?
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
One of my favourite ways of persuading libertarians to take the principle that immigration might be a problem seriously is to, I used to say this when I worked at the alternative bookshop. I would say to them, so if a bunch of people cross the English Channel in quite large numbers, you don't have a problem with that? No. If they bring guns with them, what about that? Surely you're against gun control. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've just let the Red Army
Yes, exactly.
arrive in the south of England uncontested. And you surely will concede that this is bad news for freedom as well as good. At least that.
Yeah.
And the point being to establish the principle, the logical end point of the debate, to prove that there is some kind of immigration, a combination of large numbers and the willingness to suppress freedom, that means you've got to take it seriously as a potential threat to freedom, never mind anything else.
Yeah.
Once you've conceded that, then you've kind of opened the Pandora's box of policy debate and discussion, because then, you know, where do you draw the line? Because I don't want to stop anyone. I don't want to have a complete end to immigration into Britain. No, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. But I do want to start thinking about what happens to towns in the north of England when, you know, 45% of them are Muslims or more.
Wow. Current trend, they're going to be majority Muslim, presumably.
Yeah, certainly in some towns. And that does seem to me to be a problem on libertarian grounds, never mind, you know, voting.
Which does, I mean, there's something annoying thing about it, is it gets us onto the subject of culture.
Mm. Of course it does. The whole point about the Red Army is that they've arrived with a mission to suppress freedom.
Mm. Well, I was thinking more sort of deeper culture.
Mm.
Is that the Anglo-Saxons have been remarkably good at promoting freedom over the centuries.
Mm.
And that appears to have something to do with their culture.
Mm.
And people don't give up their cultures quickly, especially if you have mass migration.
Yeah.
Another
point which we both agree is of significance is that modern communication is usually sold as the promotion of the idea of all brothers under the skin and people being able to communicate with foreigners. And that's true. There's a lot of truth in that,
mm-hmm.
provided they are inclined to communicate. And surely world trade is much bigger because of the ability of people to email, you know, the factory in China and sort out all the details of the trade.
Yeah.
It's got to be the case. However, one of the impacts of international communication is that it enables the local tribe, this is where the Lebanon thing is relevant, the local tribe can keep in touch with its parent culture,
mm-hmm.
much more easily and much more intensely. And that could potentially make these tribal battles worse, because there's no longer as much of an incentive to learn the local ways. Because if you don't learn the local ways, you won't have any ways at all. You'll just have you sitting there being a Croat or something,
well,
and nobody to talk to.
If you're living in another country, I mean, assuming there's no welfare state,
mm-hmm.
You've got to trade, and you're pretty much going to have to learn the language to trade in that language.
But the necessity of learning the language diminishes as the number of people who speak your foreign language increases, right? I mean, clearly some of them are going to have to learn English if they come here,
mm-hmm.
but there can be quite a few people who could get along.
But it always amuses me, actually, is that my observation is that Muslims tend to be very good at learning English.
Yes.
But the Nepalese, who tend not to, you know, let off bombs, are awful at it. Now, I've never met a Nepali, even quite young ones, who can speak English to even a reasonable standard.
They sound like the English. I've not met many English people who speak fluent Nepal either. But, yes. What else have I got on my list? I think I've actually covered all the things I wanted to make sure I said. What about, have you covered all the things on your list?
Yeah, I think so. That's my list, done.
And the heart of it is, we're saying to our own comrades, libertarians, you cannot just turn your back on this in an embarrassed silence. The embarrassment does you credit, the silence does you no credit at all, is what we're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, do we have any feeling as to what policy we should have?
Well, I think a lot of libertarian... I mean, every now and again somebody tries to get the Libertarian Party cracked up again. As soon as they do, and as soon as they've stopped stealing all the money and all that, whatever it is that goes on, they have to confront the question of what do we do next, not what kind of world do we want. And that's one very good question, well worth proclaiming the answer to. But what do we think should be done straight away? If not by us, then by some other government. I think immigration has that definite feeling about it, that, you know, just opening up the doors is really not the next thing to do. Not only is it clearly electoral suicide, it is not even right on libertarian grounds. That's the heart of the matter, isn't it? The problem I have with all this, I mean, this is why I wanted to make a point about how there are so many libertarian foreigners in London, whatever you call them, is that it doesn't take many bad apples to turn the whole tribe rotten. You can have lots of good people, lots and lots of good people who want nothing but a good life, a civilized life. The last thing they want is to bring the chaotic bomb-chucking politics that they ran away from to Britain. And yet they do.
Exactly.
And
well,
I feel...
We're talking about Muslims here, aren't we?
Yeah, well, of course we are. Yes. Of course we are. Of course we're talking about Muslims. They bring their bloody religion with them, which says you're allowed to do anything. It's like communism. You're allowed to do anything you like to infidels. And the only question is, will it work? But you are positively enjoined to do your best to subjugate these infidels. That's what it says. And you can say, oh, it doesn't mean that to me. That's like saying, well, King Lear has a happy ending to me. I mean, it's just wrong. It does say that. And if you think it means something else, you're wrong, I think.
But more to the point, and you've made this point, is you are spreading these ideas to the next generation.
Who might take it seriously.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, yeah. And appear to be doing so.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't take many. That's the important thing. I mean, Steven Pinker, again, a person I like his ideas a lot. He's not a libertarian. He thinks the answer to mass shootings in America is bring in gun control. Mm-hmm. Not only does he think that, he thinks it's obvious. So he's not a libertarian. Yeah. But I've now forgotten why I mentioned him. What was it? We need to do some editing with this bit, but it'll come
back.
That's
fine,
come back to that. But he points out that the number of people who die in terrorist outrages is just vanishingly trivial.
And is totally irrelevant.
Yes.
Because it's not the numbers, it's... Mm. The purpose is to impose their will on people.
Yes, yes.
And it seems to me
that... They're doing that.
They're doing that, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. And that is
that's
one of
right.
And actually, it's one of the things. Is Islam is treated different from any other religion in this country. Because there is that threat of violence.
Yes, yes. I mean, you're not allowed to say bloody Islam in polite circles, which I just did twice now. But I really hate it. I hate Islam. I don't care who knows it. And partly because it's so diabolically good at sucking good people into believing stupid things about it. Good people who are raised as Muslims.
Brian, we are going to do this as a podcast someday.
A separate one. Okay, yeah. Put that to one side.
Yeah,
it just seems to me that your point that it's all mixed up with Islam is very pertinent, because they're kind of like a Red Army of a different kind and arguably a more formidable kind. Certainly with a longer history. They are, put it this way, it's not so clear cut to me that Islamic immigration into Britain is clearly something libertarians should oppose. It's not like that. Whereas they're round the twist if they think that the Red Army should just be allowed in without any passport controls or anything. Nevertheless, the debate has that feeling about it. The Red Army objection applies to the Islamic large numbers of riots. And just pointing out, as you say, that most Muslims are thoroughly decent people, and when you buy, fruit juice from their shops, they're very charming. It's true. It's all true.
I think I'd go a bit further than you, because I don't think it's just, sad to say, just people who happen to possess a violent ideology.
Mm.
I think almost with any numbers, with any group, if the numbers are big enough, you're going to get these sorts of...
Yes.
I mean, the example would be Fiji. Now, my understanding about Fiji is a lot of Indians immigrated there, to the extent they became the majority.
Mm. No, you're quite right. You don't need... You could have an ideology which, on the face of it, has got nothing to do with pogroms, and it'll have pogroms in the right circumstances. I mean, there are sort of Buddhist terrorists in parts of Asia, I believe.
Yeah.
And there were certainly Christian terrorists, God knows. Well, I don't think God knows, but you know what I mean. And it's not so very long ago historically that you were being burnt at the stake for being the wrong brand of Christian.
Yeah.
Certainly for being an atheist. That's a good point. That's a very good point. But at the moment, yes, that's an important point, that I shouldn't get too hung up on the doctrines of Islam, because anyone can basically cobble together an explanation for why we should beat the skulls of the other bastards.
Yes.
It's not hard to do.
No.
Can happen in a week. Just a bit of scribbling and it's done. Yes. One of my beliefs, which I've long held, and we mentioned this, I think, in our First World War discussion, is that conflict causes hostility.
As in, the war starts,
and
actually a lot of the hostility then comes out later.
And then the guys with the glasses on, like me and you, sit down in our offices and concoct the propaganda and the explanations and the rationalisations of why it is that we're right to hate these swine.
Is that true?
And by the end, the people really do hate each other, which they didn't to begin with.
Yeah.
And a lot of the task of stirrers in these situations is to create hatred between groups of people who are diabolically inclined to get along with each other.
I'm trying to think is that true in the case of the First World War?
We mentioned how the British and the Germans got along pretty well, and if there was any racial animosity within Europe, it was between the North and the South.
But in 1914, almost immediately after the declaration of war, you'd see adverts in the Times saying, such and such establishment, we don't have any German or Austrian staff.
Yes.
That happened more or less immediately. But then, of course, then there were the riots in 1915 after the sinking of the Lusitania. But again, this isn't propaganda. The Germans did that.
Well, I can remember, I mean, the most recent war I can remember which did this, and was that the Argentine War, the Anglo-Argentine War about the Falklands. I mean, yes, you're right, that the propagandists are pretty quick off the mark when these things get going. And they were talking about RGs very quickly, indeed, which I don't think they'd ever done until the war broke out. I don't think RG was a word until...
No.
I'm a Spurs supporter, and I can remember...
Well, two of your players just had to go home, didn't they?
Yeah.
More or less immediately after.
Who were they? They were Ricky Villa. Ardiles, yes. But Ardiles later became the manager, didn't he? Yes. Didn't do very well, but he was liked. There was no sort of hatred of him at all that I can. Well, he was such a nice man.
Yeah.
Called it Tottingham. But perhaps what the Falklands War also illustrates, it didn't go along long enough to create that deep animosity that might. And also, there's no battleground. I mean, the great thing about the Argentines and the Brits is, if you eliminate the Falkland Islands themselves as an arena of conflict. I mean, there's two big islands in the Falklands. Imagine if the Argies had one, the Brits had the other. God help us. That would be a You'd have naval battles every night, you know, between speedboats and God knows what. But that hasn't happened. And therefore, there's no front line. There's nowhere to go if you want to have a Barney with the Argies. You go to Argentina, you're completely outnumbered and you're wasting your time.
Yeah.
If they come to England and try and start something, ditto.
Yeah.
And central to the Northern Ireland thing is that there is a place you can go to have a dust-up, isn't there? You said there weren't very many, but there was a bit. There was a bit of a place in Derry, wasn't there, where it all happened.
I mean, bombs and shooting have happened more or less everywhere.
Mm.
There are certain places where you're more likely to get them.
Mm.
But those are, yes, indeed, on the sort of front lines and in cities where you have lots of Irish, lots of British, living. Well, diversity plus proximity. Yes, and it's awfully depressing to see.
Well, the Falklands story. I mean, the outcome almost makes the point: good fences make good neighbours. Because I mean, you don't even need a fence. It's called the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah.
There must be more to be said about this. I mean, immigrants are very good for the economy.
Why don't we have a little pause for 5 minutes?
And think about what else to say. Yes, let's do that.
Right, we're recording now.
Well, we're back in business. I just want to emphasise, when I said I hate Islam, I hate what it says and what it demands of its followers. I'm well aware of the fact that most of its followers don't do what it says. Thank goodness. They are much better than their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Most Muslims are much better than their religion. And many Muslims are very much better, even than locals who don't have a religion. I mean, as is often pointed out. It's true. It's all true. And that is all part of why I hate Islam, I'm afraid. That it's so clever at sucking in good people and keeping them in. And of course, if you leave, God help you, Well, God won't help you. God will command the people to kill you. My loathing, my detestation of Islam is slightly nuanced. When somebody hears just that opinion, they will conclude all kinds of things I think which I don't think, and all kinds of truths that they think I don't know which I do know, and I'm intensely well aware of. That's the point I just wanted to make. And the other thing is that this is the bit that libertarians love to talk about, is the enormous economic value of immigrants, the different products they bring with them, cooking famously, the willingness to keep a shop open at 11 o'clock at night, which I can remember not being a fact when I was a kid. Now these are not trivial matters, and all the local shops around here are, I believe, Afghans running them. And I'm quite aware of the fact that these Afghans came here to get away from,
Afghanistan. Point out, we are recording in Pimlico. So.
Yes. Well, near Pimlico, Millbank, the other side of Vauxhall Bridge Road. But my point is, I am intensely aware of what good people I am criticising. And not very strongly. I think if you're a Muslim, I think the morally correct thing to do is to stop being a Muslim.
Yeah. But
maybe we should stop this now and have a separate discussion of Islam or something like it.
Well, I was going to sort of make a point, and this is a vague sort of half-formed thought about, I think a lot of libertarians concentrate on people as traders and economic actors.
Hmm.
And all their arguments are true, but there's also a society there, and the society is, well, this is, again, half-formed thought here. It has ideas of culture and beliefs and things like that. And when those beliefs are incompatible, then you can have a problem.
Another point worth making is that there's something a bit bizarre about two Englishmen solemnly discussing conquest as if the only conquering was being done by foreigners to us. That ought to be acknowledged. I mean, we've barged into lots of countries.
Well, you and I haven't.
No, but our ancestors, our culture has, if that's what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
At the very least, we should just nod to that fact.
Well, if a... oh, goodness, I'm really thinking off the top of my head. If some Gabonese libertarian regime invaded Britain and brought with it vastly superior technology and vastly superior beliefs, would I be complaining?
Good point. Good point. I'm thinking of the East India Company, which sort of turns up in India and ends up being the government of India.
And was it any worse than what went before or came after?
Well, there were some pretty bad things. There was a famine, but arguably caused by war.
Famines before.
Yes, that's true, I guess. Well, I just wanted to make the point that I'm aware of the existence of the British Empire.
Mm.
And if, you know, I keep coming back to it, this point. I'm imagining my libertarian friend who I'm going to be meeting again when I next attend a libertarian home meeting or when one of them comes to one of my Fridays, who's going to be saying, you do know that your country conquered mine, you know, not so very long ago. And the answer is, yes, I do. And it raises many issues, let's just put it like that. That's all I wanted to say about it.
Yes, it happened, but it's not happening at the moment.
Well, the consequences of it are still... The echoes of it are still very much happening.
I'm not sure I'm really happy to do this. I mean, you know, the British Empire pretty much ended, 50, 60 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, sort yourself out, guys. Mm. You've had a lot of time to show that independence is a better thing than being ruled by the British.
Mm. Well, I didn't want to get involved in a big discussion about the rights and wrongs of the British Empire. I just wanted to, you know, acknowledge the fact that when it comes to large numbers of immigrants piling into a country and then taking over the government, we have previous. let me put it that way. Maybe there's a bit of projection going on here. Could be that we're fearing that the world is just lusting to do to us what we've done to them. Could be.
Well, if that's part of what I've been saying, it's very well hidden from me, I must say.
Another point I want to make is that all of these fights become much more fraught if the economy is misbehaving badly, as you and I both think it is. There's two kinds of world. There's a world where everyone's getting richer, and that's true of the world in the long run, but it's not true of Britain in the short run. Lots of people in Britain are now stagnating economically and battling to just keep going. And in that world, your resentment of anyone is likely to be greater. You're going to blame rich people for you being poor. You're more likely to.
Mm-hmm.
If your life is not working, you're going to be angry about people who seem to be doing better, which may only mean, you know, local shopkeepers getting much richer than you. And it may be because they work harder, but so what? All I'm saying is the economy makes a bad atmosphere if the economy itself is not working very well. And we ought to spend an entire one of these conversations talking about economics, the whole crash and what caused it and state currencies and all that. But we have things to say about all that. I mean, good example, housing, which...
Mm-hmm.
is a very fraught issue in places where there's a big foreign community. Locals get very, very angry and resentful about that, don't they?
Well, yes. I mean, immigration does not do great things for my rent.
Hmm.
There's no question about that. And if there was less immigration, I would be better off.
In terms of the rent, you might not be better off. This is the whole libertarian argument. There might be other things happening to the economy in the absence of immigrants that would mean that you actually weren't that much better off without them. You might be worse off.
The thing is, I think I could survive a considerable amount of poverty if it meant I had more space.
Oh.
I'd trade those two to a larger... I mean, because it just makes bringing up children so much nicer. Over that age, but you still think about that as a sort of, you know, the sort of fundamental thing you want to be doing.
The thing is that all these big fraught questions have a way of impinging on each other, don't
yes,
they?
Yes.
That's the point I'm making. And another one that impinges on all this is Brexit. Again, we should have another one. We should have another conversation about Brexit. But I do believe that a very significant tranche of the votes for Brexit were to do with the feeling that immigration was out of control in Europe, and if we were part of Europe, we would be part of that state of out of controlness.
All the migrants coming from North Africa.
Once they've been allowed into Europe, then they can just cross the channel at will. That's yes. Now, that may be a caricature of what European policy really is, but that feeling surely made a difference. And you don't have to believe that every single person who voted for Brexit thinks like that, but I'm sure quite a few did.
Mm.
I did. I think that, for all the reasons we've talked about, I don't think the next libertarian thing to do in Britain is to get rid of immigration controls. I realise that's a minefield of restrictions, and how do you then, what principles do you follow? Who are you going to let in, and why, and so on. But I associate myself with that sentiment. I'm not saying, oh, lots of other terrible people in Bradford thought that. I did as well. And it had a big bearing on the result. And it only takes a single figure percentage of change in a voting situation to make a huge difference to a result. I mean, it was a 4%, wasn't it? 52 beat 48. That's not very many people who have to surprise you by voting a slightly different way to what you thought they would.
I mean, there is a counter-argument. There's a counter-argument that suggests that the polls didn't change that much in the course of the campaign. If anything, I think...
I agree. I don't think they changed much. But I think the opinion that immigration should be controlled was there all along. And I keep coming back to the sort of basic injustice of it, that because of a relatively small number of people who make it their business to start these fights, everybody else has to share the punishment, which seems so very bad. I don't like it. Well, what I mean is your control. I mean, I'm putting forward a pretty strong argument for the control, especially of Muslim immigration.
Mm,
well, most Muslims are not bad people. And insofar as they are bad, it's because they've been raised to recite bad things on whatever is the Muslim version of Sunday, you know. And it's not their fault. There's a fundamental sense in which the any more than if you get an infectious,
trapped.
I'm quite sure Islamic people listening to this, in the unlikely event that there are still any listening, to compare Islam with an infectious disease, it's not the fault of somebody with an infectious disease, but you still regard him as a menace. It has that. So these discussions have that kind of crudity and brutality about them.
War is cruel. I mean, you think of, our ancestors bombed the shit out of Germany.
Yes.
You know, lots of perfectly decent Germans got killed, but they were just regarded as the enemy. And that was that.
Mm. Yes. And to blame in the sort of way that happens in wars. Yes, no question. Just to mention on the economic point, that one of who was Brunel the winner of the greatest Englishman competition that they had on the TV?
He certainly came close. He was certainly the top.
Clarkson.
I think Winchurchill must have won it. This is about 15 years ago, wasn't it?
Brunel was very close to being regarded as the best.
Mm-hmm. Son of an immigrant. Exactly. Well, of course, Churchill was also the son of an immigrant.
Yes.
So,
There's no question this is a more interesting place to live because of him. I'm descended from, on my mother's side, from Huguenots. My mother's maiden name was Bosanquet, which is an anglicised French name.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my ancestors was the family fortune on the Bosanquet side was made by a man who traded in what was then called the Levant, I think.
My understanding is definitely up the road there's a place called Petit France. And named as such because that's where the Huguenots, refugees as they were then, all ended up. And I suspect they were subject to much the same sort of dislike.
Mm. Well, there was a whole clack of them in East London where I think they first arrived in East London.
Ah.
Where is Petit France? I've never...
It's by the Home Office.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, I don't think that was where they arrived. I think they arrived in East London.
Yeah.
But there may have been some more of them there. Maybe they stuck out more living in a posh part of town or something. And also maybe they stayed there longer and they got established to the point where there was a place name, you know. Because East London's pretty... It changes pretty fast, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it was... I was amused to read a report from contemporaneous report about the sieges of Sydney Street, which was in 1912, if I remember correctly. And the Wars report is the same. Essentially, almost no one around speaks English. They're all East Europeans. So, you know, that is obviously, in the case of Eastern Europe, East London, that's long-standing. Have we got anything else we want to say, do you think?
It's just that, well, one little tiny circumstance that was interested me. I was reading a book of all things. It was about whether Shakespeare wrote Shakespeare's plays. Connected with this was a discussion of whether there were any Jews in London at the time of Shakespeare. And it was widely believed academically that there were none. But it turns out there were some. There was a small Jewish community in London.
Which is interesting considering they were expelled.
Precisely.
And they weren't officially let back in until Cromwell's time. So they must be very small and very,
very
discreet. Yes, very quiet.
Well, they were known about by some people at the time, and this was eventually discovered. It has bearing on, you know, the Merchant of Venice. Maybe Shakespeare actually met a few of these characters, and maybe that's where he had had some effect on his writing. You know, that's what it was about. But it makes the point that immigration is an argument that's been going on a very long time, what with the Jews and all that.
Yes.
And you know, I dare not ask my local Afghan shopkeepers what they think of Jews. I can assure you I would never dream of asking them that, but I wonder what the answer might be.
I don't wonder.
No.
I can guess.
Yeah. So, in other words, lots of Muslims coming into Britain might mean that the immigration policy then becomes a lot fiercer and more discriminatory and in a different way. That's a point worth making, isn't it? Mm. I suppose. But I can feel us running out of puff. Shall we stop there?
Yeah, let's stop there.